Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
We live in a culture that is obsessed with happiness. Don't worry, be happy, we sing, and yet our happiness is circumstantial and can easily be undermined when things aren't going our way. All of the great spiritual traditions have taught us that happiness is not the same as joy, and they have shown us how to access the deep core of joy that resides within our being. My dear friend Andrew Harvey and I have recently released a beautiful book entitled Return to Joy, in which we not only clarify the difference between joy and happiness, but provide tools for accessing joy no matter what is occurring in our lives. Return to Joy is a compelling and potent invitation to the reader to consider that joy is the ultimate nature of reality and that its absence lies at the root of our current unprecedented global crisis. In this book, Andrew and I mine the mystical wisdom of the ages that places joy at the core of our existence and purpose as a species, moving forward to consider in depth the myriad enemies of joy in our time. As we tend the fires of joy, we celebrate its seven flames and nurture its ubiquitous presence, whether in the background or the foreground of our lives. Return to Joy is available on Amazon, the Barnes & Noble website, and through your local bookseller.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour with your host, Carolyn Baker.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host for today, Ivy Cohn, and with me I have the Apocalypse Twins, Carolyn Baker and Andrew Harvey.
I'm wearing the same jersey.
We're wearing the same jersey.
Well, you're twins after all.
That's true.
And in your brilliant new book, Return to Joy, you have effectively woven the two of your perspectives into a seamless, beautiful manuscript. Tell us a little bit about that.
About the seamless part?
Well, yeah. How did you come to write this so beautifully?
Well, I think it comes from our friendship, our longstanding alliance, and just how much we're on the same page about so many things. And, you know, both of us have written so much about darkness and the shadow. And we just looked at each other one day and said something like, we need to write a book about joy.
Yes.
But of course, you know,
partly because we were saying to each other, my God, we've been through so much in our lives. We've been through all the ordeals that we've been through. We've also been through the inner ordeal of watching the world go on this terrible journey into destruction. And yet at this time in our lives, we are happier than we've ever been. And we noted that fact and then said, well, don't you think it's time that we write about joy, real joy, and how it can give you the sustenance and the food that you need on this very difficult journey that we're going on at this moment?
And I think many people are surprised by the title because, you know, we have a reputation for being darkness junkies, and, you know, which is, doesn't bother us. But, you know, it is kind of surprising and it's a refreshing change. But what we really wanted to emphasize is there's no free lunch around joy. Joy is a result of some deep, hard inner work. It's very different from happiness. And, you know, it's not like the low-hanging fruit on the tree. You have to do some work for it. Right. And so there is some darkness in our book, or some shadow material in our book. But really what we emphasize is that joy is the ultimate nature of reality. It's at our core.
All the mystical traditions have known this. All the mystical traditions say with one voice that when you wake up to divine consciousness within, and the divine consciousness is actually creating everything out of which everything is created. That is not a miserable experience. That is tremendous joy. So if joy is the ultimate nature of reality, then it must be also our ultimate nature, since we all have been given, as an original blessing, divine consciousness. But how you get in touch with that joy and sustain that joy is through discipline. First, you have to have a spiritual discipline so that over time you can clean the mirror and of your heart so that the divine can reflect into that mirror the fullness of its own beauty and majesty and truth. Then you really have to look at the joy that's coming towards you from reality, from all of the different aspects of reality, from the trees, from animals, from friendships, from music, from Rumi, from Bach, from Beethoven, from the whole plethora of manifestations of joy that are around us, and train your eyes constantly to see that joy and to derive deep satisfaction from it. And then you have to sustain that discipline, because as we all know, in the world which is about to become Trump world, joy from the outside world is in short supply. We have to find it within and grow the eyes that can see it and derive great strength from it. And we have to find joy too, and this is one of the points we make very strongly in the book, from service, from action. Because I think if I'm happy at this moment in my life, it's not because the human race has taken seriously a word I've written. It's quite clearly it hasn't. It's not because I believe that there are going to be hundreds of thousands of people in a million years reading Andrew Harvey, because by 25 years, and there may be nobody on the earth. The reason why I'm happy and joyful at this moment is because I know that I'm doing the work that I'm supposed to do, that I was born to do, and I'm doing it with all the chutzpah I can and with all the passion that I can. And from that comes tremendous joy.
You know, you made a point back in there regarding noticing and being present with things like the trees and the wind and the rain. Our dominant culture does not support quiet time and silence and reflection. And we've been sold a bill of goods that we are separate and isolated. And I love the way that Derek Jensen puts it, to decolonize our hearts and minds. And your book is so much about that decolonization. You give people real...
Well, first, you have to realize how colonized your hearts and minds really are.
Absolutely.
We make a lot of... We spend a lot of time on that, because until you realize just how this culture has been set up as a flatline culture to keep you anxious, to keep you depressed, to keep you consuming, to keep you competitive, to keep you self-loathing in secret ways, until you realize that and really see it, you won't realize just what a conspiracy against your own joy you've been in all your life. And until you realize, too, the kinds of fundamentalisms that are in place. I think this is perhaps the strongest part of the book. The kind of bottom line fundamentalism of business, the fundamentalisms of religion that denigrate this whole experience in favor of a mystical otherwhere. Until you realize, my God, from all sides, this original joy is being compromised in us. Until you realize that, you'll never be able to decolonize your hearts and minds. So you've got to become conscious of the saboteurs of joy so that you can uncover and excavate your own real joy.
Mm-hmm. And it's a process that does not stop. I mean, the decolonization is an ongoing process, because it is saturated every possible molecule of our being. And so it's a task of decolonization and remembering our joy, the real essential essence joy, pretty much 24/7.
Well, it's a journey. It's a lifetime journey. And you can never look in the rearview mirror and dust off your hands and say, thank God I've decolonized myself, because that's not going to happen.
It's about as stupid as saying you don't have a shadow.
Exactly.
We're all tempted to do sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's with us. It's in our DNA. It's in our bones. And it's a process. But as we write about in all of our work, if you're willing to do the deep work, whether it's shadow work or decolonizing yourself, grief work, whatever that is.
Or the deep work of spiritual practice, which after all is a demanding work.
If you're willing to do that work, there is tremendous gold, treasure, abundance, fulfillment, meaning, and purpose in your life. And when I say abundance, I don't necessarily mean material abundance, but the abundance of life, the abundance of joy and purpose.
Mm-hmm. I can hear our, you know, perhaps not the viewers here, but the general population saying something like, well, with the world going up in flames, isn't it just a bit narcissistic to be talking about, you know, joy?
No, it's the opposite. With the world going up in flames, we need joy like oxygen. We'll all go crazy and start eating each other if we don't find this joy and realize that that is the reality that we need to be able to be strong enough and vibrant enough and juicy enough and naughty enough and wise enough and flexible enough and supple enough to actually do something about the world going up in flames. You're never going to do anything about this tormented world if you're in a state of paralyzed misery. You're only going to be able to find the energy to react from finding the core of your own joy and the extraordinary passion and compassion energy that vibrates and emanates from that place.
Mm-hmm. In answer to that question, I would just take listeners back to the book that Guy McPherson and I wrote, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, which is a conversation between us around the science and the existential realities of that science. And the big question that we were throwing out to readers in that book is, how do you want to live the rest of the time that you have? Should you walk around being depressed and in despair and saying, oh my God, it's so narcissistic of me to have one moment of joy, you know? Or do you want to tap into that joy and then take that joy, not just sit and bask in it like you would in a bathtub, but you take that joy out and you share it with the world and you allow that joy to stimulate your compassion so that you're making it easy on other species who are going extinct. You're making it on other humans, expressing joy to other humans who are troubled or don't have enough to eat or are going crazy or whatever the situation may be. So there's nothing narcissistic at all about tapping into real joy. What's really narcissistic is the happiness that our culture is always trying to sell us.
Yes, and that happiness keeps us firmly separated from real, genuine joy.
Absolutely.
That the happiness factor kind of keeps one in that flat line, as you've so well put it.
Yes.
And the upwelling of genuine joy it's not like the tap's going to get turned off.
It's boundless. It springs boundless, from the core of being. It's creating the entire universe. It's living in every animal, in every tree, in every leaf. It's living in every molecule. It's living in the dance of the whole creation. That is the creation.
Mm-hmm. So you also in this book, which I have to say is magnificently well written, you have brought so many threads together into a slim volume. I honestly think it should be a paperback that people carry around in their handbag or their backpack.
We think so too.
From your mouth to Godzilla's ears, that's exactly right.
But you spend some time talking about the adversaries of joy, and there you open that chapter. I'd like to read it. Very short sentence, but it's so powerful. No return to joy is possible without a frank, searing, unsparing exploration of everything in our culture that prevents it.
Right.
So give us some examples of what those adversaries of joy are.
Well, one of them is the corporate human, and we've mentioned, you know, this in our conversation so far, but how we are influenced by the corporate mentality, how we are encouraged to look at the world through the corporate mentality, through the bottom line, through consumption, We talk a lot about the Koch brothers in this book and how they have influenced our world and our culture. We also talk about deaf phobia and grief phobia as profound enemies of joy in our world.
Science, if you're terrified of death and you create all kinds of defenses against your fear, you'll never expand to embrace life. And it's embracing life with all of its pain and all of its difficulty that actually enables you to experience joy. And if you're phobic about grief, your heart will shrivel to the size of a pea, and it won't be able to expand to embrace the joy that life also brings.
We also talk about scientific fundamentalism, meaning that science has all the answers, there's nothing beyond science, and this is encouraged by the corporate culture. Another kind of fundamentalism, of course, is religious fundamentalism, which takes many, many forms. It doesn't have to just be, you know, Protestant right-wing Christianity.
And that's very frightening, because a lot of the religions just tell us this is a dreadful place. You're supposed to be miserable here. If you're good and sweet to each other, then perhaps you'll get to a place where you'll be in heaven and then you'll be in joy. So when you realize what saboteurs you have against discovering and living this, then you realize, my God, you've got a lot of work to decolonize your heart and your mind, but you can do it.
That's right, absolutely.
Once you can make it conscious.
Make it conscious and then get a lot of support for doing that work.
Right.
As you know, Dean Walker and I have done some symposium in the last year, and from those we've created something called the Safe Circle Online Phone Call twice a month, which is free. And we come together for 1 hour twice a month and talk about how we feel with all of this, how we're doing with all of this. And, you know, because so many of us have no place that is safe where we can go and talk about what's going on in the world and how it impacts us.
Right.
So these are the kinds of things we need to do to support ourselves. And then we have one last section in that chapter on the adversaries of joy called fundamentalism, in which we have this addiction to fun, we have this addiction to distractions, you know, anything to keep us from the heart, anything to keep us from what's really real and what's really going on.
And I think it's even nastier than that, actually. I think that there's a very, very subtle correlation between corporate domination and trying to turn people into robots for the death machine, and then injecting into them a sort of morphine drip of fun that keeps people just happy enough so as not to protest against the terrible things that are being done, or to rise up and enact a rebellion of love in action that could transform things. This is a very carefully constructed, bleak, sterile scenario.
Oh, I think that we have every opportunity under the extreme pressures of what's going on globally on every level to recognize that the dominant paradigm has effectively created a bunch of zombies. And if we really want to be alive, genuinely alive, and fully engaged with presence.
Yes. And not just with presence either, with the work of love in action, with
well, success. and that's exactly it, Andrew.
Otherwise, how will we respond? Nobody's going to try and change themselves to be strong enough to react to the situation if they don't love life. And how could you love life if you're not joyful, if you're not experiencing the joy of life? If you can keep people gray and miserable and limited and narrow and consuming, you can also keep them from rebelling. Because what would they rebel for? What would they fight for? What would they struggle for if life is so meaningless and so boring and so sterile?
A full presence life allows one to move into action.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that can inspire you, but certainly it's the only thing that can sustain you in action. Because as you know, and as Carolyn knows, and as I know, when you stand up for compassion and for justice in a world like this, you are not immediately adored, and you are certainly not immediately supported. Very often you have to undergo great ordeals of poverty, great ordeals of being derided and called a crazy person. And how will you find the courage to do what you have to do, to stay a human being and to become someone who helps with this great birth, if you're not joyful in the core of your being and if you're not deriving that peculiar strength that can only come from experiencing joy?
Mm-hmm. I could not agree with you more. And we need great courage right now.
Yes.
And the courage for me, as you have pointed out, comes from knowing that the joy is eternal. It doesn't change.
No.
It doesn't change. And so from that, I can get courage for what?
But only if you experience it. You know, you can talk about these things.
Oh, no, it's not a head thing.
It's not a head thing. You need to know two things. You need to know that joy is the essential nature of reality. That's the bliss force that's creating everything. And you need to know that you can connect with it directly in the most extraordinary way, through spiritual practice, through uncovering all of these saboteurs, through making conscious your shadow, and through radical service. And that's the message of our book, because I think people are going to need this message like oxygen, because otherwise madness, chaos, and the end of the planet. Because the worst case scenario is that people not only will be driven into madness by what's about to unfold, but that they will actually do nothing. They'll just go into paralysis and watch the dark forces annihilate everything. This would be a catastrophe and the most disgusting end to our adventure. We've got to get the power inwardly to go through this next period doing everything we can calmly, wisely, sanely, joyfully, whatever happens. Otherwise, we won't even die human.
This is true. That's why your book, this particular book, is so, so vitally important at this time. I've read it through once, and I'm heading back to start at the beginning and go through it again. Even though I have spent a great deal of my life cultivating that relationship with joy, it doesn't hurt to just reinforce it, because what we're facing is going to take a tremendously solid relationship with joy.
That's it.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So in cultivating joy in our lives and our communities, the action items, can you suggest to our listeners?
Of course. The most important thing is to realize that there is a great force that we can relate to on the earth. And it's a force that I call sacred activism. It's a force we've seen in operation in history. And this force is created by the fusion of the two noblest passions in the human soul, the passion for God and the passion for justice. If you bring these passions together, a third holy force is born. We've seen it work in Gandhi. We've seen it work with Martin Luther King. We've seen it blazing in the Dalai Lama. We've seen it have immense effect. So that's the force that can potentially transform even this horrible situation that we find ourselves in. At least we have a window of opportunity in which it could transform us. The next thing we need to realize is that we're all being called to serve a single sacred mission that belongs to us uniquely. And there's a way of finding out what that mission is, and that is by asking yourself, what causes me the deepest heartbreak? It's a paradox, but like everything else with the divine, it's a paradox. Ask yourself what causes you the deepest heartbreak, and then allow yourself to turn up to do something about it, and strangely enough, you'll be fed great energy, great passion, and great joy, because you know then that your life means something. It has a meaning and a purpose, and that you're doing things that really reach out to others and help them. And that brings the deepest joy of life, far more than owning Malibu mansions or a Maserati or all the kind of garbage goals that this culture tries to persuade us will make us truly happy.
And we have a whole chapter on cultivating joy, the many flames of joy. And I'm not going to list all of them right now, but these are ways to cultivate joy, not only within ourselves, but within our communities. And they're very infectious.
Yes.
And the more we experience them personally, the more we want to share them with our communities and with people we love.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that our culture has is constantly keeping us from is resting, is silence, is solitude. People are terrified to just be with their own thoughts and their own hearts.
Yes.
So I, again, I'm going to read a very brief excerpt from that chapter. Related to solitude is simply the joy of resting. The joy of consciously giving oneself the time to relax without any purpose. Animals are superb teachers regarding the joy of resting.
Yes.
Because they shamelessly love resting, which takes them to a state of equilibrium and well-being.
Yes.
So, you know, many people are going to feel quite guilty and uncomfortable in silence and rest. Well, Carolyn, how can we, you know, encourage people to set aside that guilt?
Well, first of all, you know, I think it's a process. And the minute you feel that guilt or that, you know, antsiness because I'm not doing something, I'm just sitting here. Isn't this selfish? Isn't this privileged? Isn't this narcissistic or whatever? Just to notice that and to remember that that's a message from my culture. That's corporate culture telling me that I should be doing something other than being present with myself.
An Aboriginal would never feel guilty. I've been with Aboriginals. Right. They love to sit on rocks and vibrate with the universe. They feel that's the essential meaning of life. They never are happier than when they're doing absolutely nothing, sitting on a rock, being one with all their relatives around us. This is true of all Indigenous cultures. Indigenous cultures don't overwork. They spend a great deal of time just in silently, tenderly hanging mm-hmm. out with each other. They don't even do a lot of talking. Mm-hmm. They communicate beyond the ways in which we communicate in ways that seem to make them extraordinarily happy. I remember being in the middle of the Amazon with the Achuas, and they all came to see us, and we sat in the most amazingly full silence for about 2.5 hours with people who were completely at ease physically, mentally, spiritually with each other and with their world. Nobody said anything and nobody did anything, but what was said and done in that silence of communion was so extraordinarily beautiful that even thinking about it now fills my whole body with joy.
Well,
that's how we were meant to live.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you sit quietly, you're not used to doing that. And you sit down, you sit quietly, and all these thoughts and anxieties and antsiness come up. I think the best thing you can do at that point is pay attention to the body. Because the reason all this antsiness is coming up is that we have all been completely conditioned to be in our heads, out of our bodies, disconnected from our bodies. And that's where we're going to find all the answers, and that's where we're going to find the meaning of life, and yada, yada. And so to bring that energy down into the body and just be present with what the body is experiencing. And then, you know, you may want to, after doing 10 or 15 minutes of that, you might want to write about that in a journal. Or you might want to draw it if that's your thing, if you're more, you know, artistically inclined. So it's a practice, you know, and we don't for 1 minute believe that people who've been heavily colonized in this culture can just sit down, be at rest, everything's okay, right off the bat. It's going to take some time because it's very foreign to our lifestyles.
Well, there might be two intermediary stages. You know, to people who find it difficult to sit down in silence and just be with themselves, I say, why don't you start playing? Write something, draw something, dance. That's a wonderful thing. So I'm used to the idea that your identity isn't conditioned by your paycheck or the kind of person other people think you are. Experience something of the juicy creativity of your own nature. And another beautiful way is to just go for a walk. Just say, I am so sick of being stuck in this exhausting mind game that I'm playing with myself and with the world. I'm just going to go out for 10 minutes. And I find that if I just walk around the block twice where I live in Oak Park, I'm suddenly in the great, silent, spacious consciousness that is actually infiltrating and alive in everything.
Yeah.
I want to read another line from your book, and hopefully you two can expand. It's in the same vein as what you're talking about. In a happiness-addicted culture, it is crucial to notice the stark contrast between hoping for happiness and the conscious cultivation of joy as a result of metabolizing meaning. And that's the juicy bit for me right there, the metabolizing meaning.
Well, now you see you're interviewing us, but I want to interview you.
I do too. What does that mean to you, Ivy?
You're radiating joy. You know how frightening we are, what situation we're in, and yet you're committed and joyful because you found meaning. So how do you metabolize meaning and joy and sorrow?
Excuse me. I'm almost at a loss for words because it's not even something that is easily articulated.
No.
It's giving myself the opportunities to have enough space.
Yes.
And enough quiet with no agenda in my mind, and that those meanings and bits and pieces of things that perhaps I've been intermittently thinking about or meditating on, perhaps for months, suddenly there's a focus that just comes.
Yes.
And that is a metabolized meaning then.
Well, it might be that you, in silence, you dance with your unconscious consciously. Mm-hmm. And that your unconscious, which is always longing to help you metabolize meaning, as well as to throw all kinds of strange monkey wrenches into the meanings that you create, that unconscious can then crystallize things at a greater depth because you're giving it time and you're consciously setting out to dance with it, to invite its subtlety and its messages into your life. Artists need a great deal of time just to lollygag. They seem to be doing nothing, but they're not doing nothing. They're actually allowing the universe to speak to them the unique words or the unique, or to transmit to them the unique sounds if they're a musician, that they are given to transmit to others. It's simply impossible to be an artist at any authentic depth unless you are training yourself to be silent in this way, to receive the inspiration that comes, yes, from within you, but actually in a more strange and mysterious way from the whole universe itself, from the divine consciousness itself.
I find that for me, metabolizing meaning is a whole lot about being in my heart and letting myself feel whatever is going on in my heart. It may be compassion, it may be heartbreak, but if I allow the full emotion of my heart, to just allow it, to just see it, to notice it, something shifts for me. And when I say shift, that means for me metabolizing meaning, and then I have a different perspective on what is happening for me.
I would just like to cycle back to the notion of sitting quietly, not having any agenda in your mind. For myself, I spent a great deal of my life multitasking, and I was just go, 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 do, do, do all the time. And I realized a number of years ago that was not healthy. It was part of that overlay of the culture on my being. And it was extremely uncomfortable when I first started just sitting and doing nothing, just deliberately choosing to sit for 5 minutes and do nothing and have no thoughts. A thought would come. That's the thought. You're out of here. I'm just sitting here. I'm feeling the sun, the wind on my skin. It was so uncomfortable. And I just stayed with it. I just kept practicing that. And eventually it came to the place where I really just want to sit around and do nothing all the time, because from that, like an animal,
place, isn't it?
It's a great place, because suddenly from that complete resting in the joy comes this incredibly invigorated action. And now I'm it's like, well, how can I find some time to sit around and do nothing? Because from that comes such a sustenance.
Absolutely. Children know this, animals know this, sages know this, Aborigines know this, all of the indigenous peoples know this. We've forgotten this, and that's why we're such miserable people, creating a completely unacceptable and awful world and then being paralyzed by what we've been creating. So let's get back to our original nature of joy. Let's experience it in the simple ways that it's offered to us. And refreshed by that dynamic and gorgeous simplicity, let's go forward, love our lives, and serve the great birth that's trying to take place in this horrendous chaos. It's here, it's waiting for joyful, simple, humble servants to turn up to midwife here.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you two have not only written this fabulous book, Return to Joy, but I believe you have an upcoming symposium of the same title.
We do, starting February 2nd. It'll be four nights in February. It's a Tuesday night, February 2nd, 9, 16, and 23. And people can go to my website, carolynbaker.net, and register just with a click. And what we're going to do is go more deeply into the book. We might have a couple of guests. I don't know for sure who they might be at this moment, but we are going to go deeply into joy and have dialogue and conversation about this. We're going to share some practices, some tools that people can use to really make this real for themselves. So it's not just this big head experience we're all going to learn more. It's going to be...
We're going to enjoy it.
We're going to enjoy...
together.
Being present together. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, that's just lovely. So you've now done one book together. And what's coming down the pike? Is there another book that you two are conjuring?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, we're in Carolyn's study right at the moment, and we are cooking a pretty devastating and wonderful book, actually. I'm really loving every bit of it. It's called Straight Talk for the Dark Night of the Globe. So we've decided that since we're now elders, we can get away with telling what we believe to be the truth without any decoration about where we are, what we need to be, and how we need to act. And we're just going to write a plain Jane, no-nonsense primer about how to get through these times and remain resilient and joyful and productive, whatever happens. We're not under any illusions as to where we're going. We could be very well going towards complete extinction. But we know from our own lives that if you approach this tremendous and sometimes terrible adventure with real tools, inner and outer, it can become a way of really entering into the depths of life and expressing the fullness of your personality, even if, as may be possible, the entire planet goes into the dark. So we're writing a book called Straight Talk for the dark night of the globe, and we're going to be really exploring four separate but interlinked things. We're going to be exploring reconnection to self, to earth, to community, to sacred activism, resistance, because we've got to have a resistance movement in place. Nothing will happen at all. We'll just go straight towards extinction if there isn't a worldwide resistance movement based on deep nonviolent principles and with a great passion for justice and for restoring nature. This has to come soon because the window is closing. And if that doesn't happen, then we're still going to have to find how to resist whatever is going on from deeper and deeper places within ourselves. The third thing that we're going to be talking about a great deal is resilience, because resilience will always be important, whether we're fighting for a new world peacefully or whether we're enduring extinction. And the fourth is regeneration, which will be active in all of the different stages of the crisis as it unfolds. Even if we're facing extinction, those of us who truly take love seriously, truly take justice towards other species seriously, will be challenged to live in such a way that we leave the world to others in as least devastated way as we can. So we're really writing a primer from the apocalypse, and we're trying to keep it clean, clear, no-nonsense, pragmatic, helpful, because that's the way elders speak. They don't mince their words.
Right.
They try and lay out the map. They see what they see. They give the kind of clear advice that they can, but they also offer as much help as they can.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I see that the turning around and extending the hand to those who are not as practiced yet in these things, this is a very important piece. So the work you're doing is giving real, practical, concrete handholds is what I like to call them.
Right. Mm-hmm. And to accept the us. I mean, it's both. Yeah. One hand is giving, you know, take this, and the other hand is saying, come on, come on, right. Get real, get down, get
yes.
going.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We're not nannies. We're pretty strong cookies, you know, and we want to really warn people, tell them where we think we could go unless there are major transformations, hold out the hope for those transformations, give the map for those transformations that we know and have been graced to understand, and then give the help for whatever happens. That's what a true elder in this time is really being invited to do, it seems. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a time frame for this book to be completed?
Yes.
Yeah, we would like this book to be out in the world in June.
Oh, wonderful.
I told Carolyn this morning that my great dream is to produce this book, which I consider one of the most important things I've ever worked on, because I get to work on it with her, is my birthday's on June the 9th, so at 65 I'd like to give this book to the world as a gift.
Lovely. Well, I'm in agreement with you that that will happen.
It must happen. We shall manifest it. We shall watch The Secret 14 times and say, see, manifested, and there it will be.
We're not going to watch
The Secret. We're not going to watch The Secret.
Trust us.
Oh, goodness. Well, one of the things about your current book, Return to Joy, that I found just delightful and so deeply comforting was the interweaving of so many beautiful poems. And one in particular that has long been a favorite of mine because it so brilliantly portrays why we're here. And Carolyn, I would just love for you to read that if you would be so kind.
Well, it would be my great joy to read this poem by Jewel Matheson, who graciously gave us permission to use this in the book. And of course, it's called We Have Come to Be Danced. We have come to be danced, not the pretty dance, not the pretty, pretty pick me dance, but the claw our way back into the belly of the sacred, sensual animal dance, the unhinged, unplugged, cat is out of the box dance, the holding the precious moment in the palms of our hands and feet dance. We have come to be danced. Not the jiffy booby, shake your booty for him dance, but the wring the sadness from our skin dance, the blow the chip off our shoulder dance, the slap the apology from our posture dance. We have come to be danced. Not the monkey see, monkey do dance, one, two, dance like you, one, two, dance like me dance, but the grave robber, tomb stalker, tearing scabs and scars open dance, the rub, the rhythm raw against our souls dance. We have come to be danced, not the nice, invisible, self-conscious shuffle, but the matted, hair-flying, voodoo mama shaman shaken, ancient bones dance, the strip us from our casings, return our wings, sharpen our claws and tongues dance, the shed dead cells and slip into the luminous skin of love dance. We have come to be danced. Not the hold our breath and wallow in the shallow end of the floor dance, but the meeting of the Trinity, the body, breath, and beat dance, the shout hallelujah from the top of our thighs dance. Mother, may I? Yes, you may take 10 gigantic leaps dance, the ollie ollie oxen free, free, free dance, the everyone can come to our heaven dance. We have come to be danced where the kingdoms collide, in the cathedral of flesh, to burn back into the light, to unravel, to play, to fly, to pray, to root in skin sanctuary. We have come to be danced. We have come.
And on that incredibly joyous note, it has been a pleasure and a delight to be with both of you today.
And with you.
And with you, Ivy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for appreciating this book, which we really loved writing, and we hope that everybody listening will plunge into and learn from, because nothing is more important now than to get to the source of your joy and to live out whatever life you have with chutzpah, exuberance, passion, and commitment to service.
You bet.
Until next time.
Thank you for joining us today. You can hear all podcasts and learn about Carolyn Baker's other works at www.carolynbaker.com. www.joyfulbeing.net. Her daily news digest is available by subscription and is delivered to your inbox 7 days per week with real news on economics, environment, geopolitics, civil liberties, and cultural issues, plus links to articles on inspiration and resilience. Come sail with us again next week on the Lifeboat Hour.